Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Thriving Adoptees podcast. So today I'm delighted to be joined by a new friend of mine called David. David, welcome to the show. Great to see you, buddy.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, Simon. Thank you.
Yeah. Could you introduce yourself to the audience, please?
Well, that's a tough question. Yeah, I'm 71 years old. Recently took on the mantle of calling myself retired, which means kind of do the same things I've been doing, but I don't get paid for it. spent a lot of time in business. I was a late developer in life itself, went to college, but fell short of a degree and wandered from here to there and different types of jobs, and eventually found my place in life and with a small business that a partner and I had started. Got married. My wife wanted to adopt a Chinese baby, and I thought, no, there's got to be better things we can do with our life. Like, let's try raising rabbits and goats and pheasants and peacocks and turkeys. And it didn't seem to fill her need. She had two biological children when I married her, young ones. So we started fostering and ended up adopting our first foster child when he was 6 years old. Went on to foster, I think, a little over 27 kids and adopted four of them from the system. And somewhere in that process, I, through our foster care agency, was able to meet Brian Post from the Post Institute. He was in Virginia Beach doing a training for Old Dominion University, and foster care agency booked him for this parenting boot camp. So I dragged my wife to it, and it changed the whole course of my career, of my life. And eventually we went into business with Brian and his wife, my wife and I, after we sold our business in Virginia Beach. Worked with Brian for 10 years, taking a lot of his material and encapsulating it in home study courses and actual books. And then a couple years ago, we actually gave the business away to his wife, or ex-wife at this point now. But I continue to write articles for the foster care adoption communities, and have also started a couple of nonprofits, one of which I run called the Love More Institute.
Yeah.
That brings you up to the present.
That's right. I mean, when I saw this Love More Institute, I thought, this is the guy for me. You know what I mean? I thought, Love More Institute. You know, I hear people saying, you know, I hear some people saying, you know, well, love isn't enough. And I say to myself, well, it's a really good place to start. You know what I mean?
Yes,
I know. It's got to be the ultimate foundation for everything, isn't it? You know, I'm a big fan of heart over brain, and love over psychology. So, how did you come up with the name Love More Institute?
Well, I had helped another woman start a nonprofit called the Homeless Entrepreneur Suitcase to Briefcase 8-week training to help homeless people start their own businesses. And somehow through the process of doing that, I got very involved with them and other marginalized groups of people who didn't seem to have the same opportunities offered to them. And a friend of mine was my former partner in the business that we ran in Virginia Beach. He and I are still very close. We have a small book club that meets on the phone every Friday for 4 to 6 hours with he and his wife. And he really was the factor in my starting the Love More Institute. And I think he came up with the name, but he was encouraging me continually. And he encouraged us with the homeless people as well and provided some funding for that organization. And I thought, well, there's no better place that I wanted to go that was non-denominational, let's say, non-religious, non-scientific, but somehow was able to pull all of those things together in some sort of a platform that could speak to everyone who was interested in love, which I guess we have a pretty wide audience, at least potentially for that. So that's where we went with it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not a niche market, is it? Well, I guess it is in some ways, because everybody's thinking, oh, well, the psychology and the success, and that's going to give me the answers. But, you know, who doesn't want more love in their life? So what I'd love to do is hear a little bit more about what you've learned that helps. Well, let me take a step back, right? So the name of this podcast, right, is the Thriving Adoptees Podcast. So something that I often do is I ask the guests what they understand when they hear that phrase, thriving adoptees. So what comes to your mind when you hear that, David?
Yeah, I've listened to a couple of your podcasts and remember you're asking those questions. When we got into foster care, I realized, I mean, very early on, that there was no training that was possible to prepare people for what it was like to work with foster kids. I mean, they gave us training and they tried to help us, but it just was not possible. So early on, I learned that these kids were trauma histories, you know, every one of them. And we were working with, we had a fairly big house and a property in the country that we could, with all these animals and play sets. And we thought, what a wonderful place to raise kids. They can't run away because there's no place to go. So right off the start there, I was realizing that thriving for these children, although some of them were brilliant, and our first adopted son was a good case of that. When we had him tested for Asperger's when he was 18, the doctor said, first of all, he said he's in the top 15% of IQs of all the adults across the world. And secondly, he couldn't even score him on three tests because he didn't get anything wrong. He said, I've never seen anybody not get anything wrong on these tests. So I realized also that we had genius in a child who was probably the most problematic child of all the kids we ever had, which was our first adoptee. adopted child. He was, you know, he had many records that he broke, like getting expelled from two different schools on the same day for two different reasons. We had to put him in two residential programs, three if you consider a private day school that we put him into, all at a lot of great expense, and not one of them was able to really help him. So thriving for these children was going to have to be, are they in jail? No. Are they dead? No. And then if we wanted to go further, are they into drugs or alcohol? No. So they're thriving. There's a lot of street smarts in these children. But in terms of being able to work well and play well with others, it was really hard for them. So we have our oldest child that we adopted at 21, she's gone on to her master's program. She has a master's in international politics. She works for a large nonprofit. She has shown us, in a sense, what a true thriving adoptee could turn out to be, but that's not without its, you know, without its hangups and without its problems, issues that we keep very close to our hearts, at knowing that these children, no matter how old they are, still run into abandonment issues, still run into problems of working well and playing well with others. So what does thriving mean? You're not dead, you're not in jail, you're not on drugs and alcohol.
Okay. That's a pretty alternative view to what I've heard from the rest of the guests. I love it, yeah. It's that expectations thing, isn't it? And Yeah, I don't know if you can hear all the commotion going on. We've just a friend's just arrived, and the dogs are kicking off in the background. Can you hear that?
Yeah, a little bit.
The listeners can hear that too, and now she's making about a 16-degree turn in the drive just to make a little bit more noise and prolong it. I'm going to change tack then. What I'd love you to do if you're up for it is to share the essence of what that you've learned to help these kids thrive as you define it.
That would have to go back to the parenting boot camp that we took with Brian Post. I had heard the term unconditional love for many years. I've been in the self-improvement, self-development movement since 70s, I think. Yeah, since the early 70s. Been a meditator since the late 60s. Very contemplative in my approach to things. And back then, they used to call it the New Age. I don't know what they call it these days. But unconditional love was something that I had heard that I thought I understood. But it wasn't until really 2005 when we did this camp with Brian that he, in this weekend training, showed us very specifically what unconditional love was, which meant that there was nothing that a child could do to earn it and nothing that a child could do to lose it. There was no earning respect. There was no expecting anything from a child in return for this love. There was just appreciating love at the most extreme behaviors, let's say. And by the time I left that weekend, I realized that all the tools that we had as parents, all the leverage that we were taught, was pretty much gone in the realm of unconditional love. You know, the timeouts, the punishments, the limits, not limits really. I could redefine that a little bit later, but any punitive approach, any reasonable approach by trying to help kids to understand when their brains, you know, aren't going to be fully developed, maybe until they're 25, and most of these kids are going to come in a little later. All of that reason, logic, punishment all goes out the window. And you you learn to adopt, and this goes for beyond the kids, because one of the things by the end, let me go back. By the end of that workshop, I went to Brian and I said, you've taken away everything that we as parents have for leverage. How do we live in a world that's upside down and inside out when you take away all of this? Our whole justice system, our whole world is based on reward and punishment. You've taken that away. What do we do with this? And he was able to, you know, in a few words, really just help me to understand. And I'll give you this example that just kind of blew me away. He said, so let's say we're going to tell Joey to take out the garbage. And Joey says, no. And Brian, he's a big man, you know, former football player, college football player. He's standing there and he says, Joey, I need you to take out the garbage. Joey goes, no. And Brian falls backwards onto the floor and he's laying there. And he says, wow, Joey, you know, you only act this way when you're stressed or upset about something. What's going on with you? And that was the beginning of Gandhi would call that the nonviolent approach to the max, where you actually just become completely vulnerable to your children. Not in a doormat way. Understand there's so many different variables that come into play here. And for some people, they just toss it out, like rewarding your children when they misbehave. They don't even want to hear those words. But I have found some very interesting and workable processes for rewarding children when they're misbehaving. And I got that from a therapist. Who actually had promoted Brian Post in one of his talks to the foster care people. So I left that weekend and went to work, and I was managing a small business of 15 people, the one that we owned. And I started using this approach on my employees and my boss I tried it on my wife, but she would say, don't you try that Brian Post stuff on me. So I had to find a little bit different way with her. But what Brian had said is essentially, for love will work on pretty much everybody. Typical kids, you can treat them almost any way you want, and they're going to turn out okay, typical kids. But for these kids with trauma histories, they need to have this unconditional love approach because of their abandonment issues, because of their attachment disorders, all the stuff that we know that they come with, they need something. So I started using this on my employees and found this is just a way to live with people. I mean, this has got to be great for presidents of companies and countries, as well as kids with trauma histories. So that was the beginning in 2005. And I have done pretty much all of my work in that direction, helping people to implement, to work toward a place where they can love unconditionally, and to give them some, well, psychological framework for it, as well as scientific. Anything that I can bring in the material world that helps people to move into a place where loving is something that, how would I say it, comes naturally instead of trying to love, let's say. And it's not an easy job. It's not an easy work to deal with, because love has so much baggage associated with it, that to bring it to a level where it's accessible and understandable in a non-romantic, non-erotic, non sort of typical way that we see love. It's a long road, but I still have time, so.
Yeah. So the first question is, I watched a video with Brian this morning being interviewed. And I saw that he's a big guy. So when he fell over, right, and laying on the floor, did the room shake?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it did. He did a number of things that shook the room.
Yeah, another thing. So, yeah, one thing is that you said that Brian had showed you this, right? Now, I believe that we have to see things kind of like we can be shown stuff, but we have to see it for ourselves. Yeah. So it's not what we say, it's what our kids hear, or what anybody, it's not who we're communicating. It's not what I say to you, it's what you hear from me. Right. So I'm guessing that he kind of pointed you in this direction. He showed you it, but you had to see it for yourself. You had to experience this for yourself.
So that's the long road.
That's the long road. Yeah. Well, this is the long road. Yeah. And on that long road of seeing stuff for ourselves, what have you found to be the most effective ways for parents of kids from hard places to help them see this for themselves, see what this truly is, this unconditional love, what it is?
my gut response to that is, I don't know that any of them would identify it or would say, yeah, it was so incredible with the Jarovis. They were just loving me unconditional. I don't think that they would really even be able to verbalize it, nor could they define it in any way. I know that we made incredible differences in people's lives. I also know that if I knew then what I know now, it would have been an entirely different bringing up process, because we made way too many mistakes on that long road in helping these kids. Looking back, we failed as much as we succeeded, but we did manage to bring something to these children's lives that I think very few people have been able to do for them or bring to their lives. And how it mattered was in each of the cases that we dealt with them, I think we made an impact. And I know that we had to go to court for a number of these children and fought for them. We were able to create a turn of events, let's say, that nobody thought would happen in the children's lives. And we're still in touch with a number of them today. This is, gosh, 25, 26 years later, we're still in touch with some of these. And I know that we had an effect, but even with those closest to us, I don't think it's as recognizable as I would like it to be. But that doesn't change my direction in terms of loving unconditionally. And that's a hard term to define, other than there's nothing they can do to earn it and nothing they can do to lose it. And that in itself still takes quite a bit of contemplation to see how to apply that on a day-to-day basis. But I know that anytime I act in a punitive way, which I still do to this day, that I'm not coming from love at that point. And punitive could be just simply, let's say my wife and I are having a little spat or something, and she's a little this or that. You know, my typical response would be, okay, fine, I'll never say anything again. You know, that's not unconditional love. That's me putting up my shield, you know, putting on my armor and saying, you know, that's fine, I'll just never talk again. It's those kind of things that come across much more subtly at this point in my life after lots of practice. But back then, you know, it could have been grabbing someone and trying to force them physically to do things, brush their teeth, for instance, when in the early days when we really struggled with kids. All of that goes out the window. And when you see that it's not needed, first of all, and it's not necessary to punish, to use timeout, to use restrictions or any kind of takeaway, particularly since if you take away things from foster kids, they don't care because they don't have anything anyway. So it's kind of a moot point. They usually will say, go ahead, take everything away. I don't care. It's not a good leverage point even to begin with at a reasonable level. But I'll give you an example. We were in one of these talks that the foster care agency would bring together, and there was a therapist in it. He's the first guy that I had heard mention the Post Institute. And he said, sometimes when I'm in a therapy with these kids, and I find that they're, you know, cross-armed and locked up and solid, he said, I'll just throw them a piece of candy and they'll reach for it. And they'll smile. And he says, I gotcha. And then he said, sometimes I'll actually say, you having trouble talking? Got something on your mind? Let's go play some baskets. So they go out and they shoot some basket, and the kid starts moving, and all of a sudden the kid loosens up. And I was bumping my wife and I said, oh, listen to this. I said, this is great. This is great stuff. And my wife turned to me and said, we're not going to reward kids for misbehaving. So one of our children, our first adopted kid, I said to him one day, I need you to sweep the garage. And he said, no. I said, James, I need you to sweep the garage. And he runs out of the garage. I don't know, he must have been about 6 or 7 at the time, jumps on his bike. We had 3 acres at this time, so there was a lot of room for him to go, and he takes off. And my initial impulse, of course, is to run after a kid. You know, he's not going to get away from me. So I'm already in the attack mode. So I get up to his bike, and all of a sudden I get this point where this is where the rubber meets the road. What am I going to do? So I knelt down just to look at him eye to eye. And I said, hey, you want to go shoot some baskets? And he says, yeah. So we go out and we start shooting some baskets and we start laughing and having some fun, and he's loose and I'm loose. And we end the game and he says, hey, I think I'll go sweep the garage for you, Dad. I was shocked. I mean, I literally was shocked. And when you see things like that starting to work, now, it didn't mean that he never misbehaved again. Of course he didn't. But the point was, I didn't have to punish him to get him to do something or threaten him in any way. And a similar event happened. Brian and I actually went to a school. It was an entire school for troubled kids in Northern Virginia. And he gave this talk, and one of the teachers, they were all like completely defensive. They were telling him basically that you can't love these kids. You've got to have, you know, rooms to put them in, timeout rooms that are padded and all that. I mean, these were some tough kids. And they said, this kid, every time we hand him a test paper, he just crumples it up and throws it on the floor. And Brian said, here's what I would do. I would take the test paper and put it on my desk. And I'd say, Billy, if you want to take the test, just come on up here and get it. So he finished the talk. And I mean, it was a really good talk, but I could tell there was a lot of resistance. We get a letter from the principal a week later saying, we tried exactly what you said. And Billy came up, took the test paper, and finished the test for the first time. I don't know if this is really clear about this resistance kind of push and pull thing that we go through with kids, with our threats, we threaten them with anything, but withdrawing love is the worst thing that we could do. And Brian's approach of unconditional love was so different that it has taken me, 15 years to really get deep into it and to be able to feel comfortable talking about it with parents or writing about it.
Are there any principles that you could share to help people understand this? Because I'm asking you for principles. I'm not asking you for applications, because I can see that this is such a fundamental turnaround to traditional parenting that we can't really. This isn't about strategies. It's something way deeper than that. But this is a podcast, so we can only do what we can do to share the stuff with the listeners. So what could you say in terms of principles or any other take? You have the floor. What would you like to share with the listeners to help them move in this direction?
Well, let me start here. Ryan used to say this, and I think this is a critical principle, is parents can't take their children where they themselves haven't gone. So if parents have trailing trauma in their life, let's say for starters, or personal work that they haven't done, and they're still parenting from an old paradigm, let's say, they may have an intention to love unconditionally, but when a child triggers their own sort of, what they bring to the table is, don't you talk to me that way. I am the parent, you are the child. When a parent is triggered, loving unconditionally is not even a possibility. So Brian never believed in child therapy. His work was always, always, always with the parents. In fact, he still does this to this day. He'll go into a parent's, into a family's home and actually live there for a few days so that he can begin to see the situation of the family environment and how it works, and also work with the parents, because the parents are key in the child's development. So the work that I do currently in my writing, and I've got a couple of books that I'm working on from all of this work, is for the parents to do the work on themselves so that they don't react, and so their amygdala doesn't take over, just like their child's amygdala, hijacks their responses. When a parent can come to see that they are experiencing the same thing that their children are going through, they're getting triggered, and can stand firm and not go off into the don't you ever, you know, anytime this stuff starts to happen, pointing fingers or a threatful voice, when they can start to see that in themselves and drop that. And he's got it's called the 3R formula. It's the first thing you do is stop and begin to be mindful of what's going on in your body at the time. Your arms are tightening, your breathing is increasing, your voice is going up. Stop, relate to the child. What that means is stop for a moment, breathe, start to see things from the child's point of view. And once you step into more of a personal awareness of what you're going through, you have at least a fighting chance to get to a point of loving that child. But if you're still pent up in the way you were taught, in the way people tell you to behave, you're not going to have much of a chance with those children. So the principles are, and yes, there actually are numerous ones. I probably should have this. There was an article that we recently did that encapsulated it. So I'll read you these actually from that article. So reflect is the first part of the 3 R's. Stop, reflect on what's going on in you in particular, and then start to relate to the child. And the third step is regulate. Is regulation happens when we just stop fighting with each other, when we stop fighting with ourselves. So the 3 R's is the basic set of principles that we would use in helping parents to change the way they react to their children's behaviors. And then he goes on, there's a number of them that are so very powerful. Facial expressions, start to watch your own facial expressions. The timing, leave spaces. Don't start going off into lecture mode, which is, I've always been a great lecturer, so I understand that. Intensity, how intense is the parent responding? Is it coming from a, wow, usually you don't act like this, what's going on? Or is it a, don't you ever, or I've told you not to, or go to your room, or whatever it is parents like to do. Tone of voice, gestures, you know, are we using threatening gestures, like our hands in particular, our face can be very threatening. And then eye contact, being able to maintain eye contact even when your child doesn't, and not to demand that your child look at you, which is one of the things that Karen Purvis used to talk about. And I know you had a guest on that did some work with Karen Purvis. Is most parents in a culture that we grew up in want the kids to look at them, you know, look at me. And demanding that a child look at you when they've got all kinds of trauma going on and things that are getting triggered, that's the last thing they want to do. So looking at them and not expecting or demanding them to look back at you allows them to step into a place of safety, because they're no longer going to get hit, punished, or worse in some cases for whatever way they behave. So that's like 9 steps in there, principles that can be used. And there's a lot more to be said about them, but just very simply said, it's bringing your own presence to an interaction with your child in a non-threatening, non-punitive way of expressing yourself. And one that, in a sense, wraps your arm around the child, no matter what they just did or what they just said to you.
We'll put a link on there on the show notes to that, in the show notes to that, listeners. So have you heard of a guy called Rupert Spira? You come across him?
Yeah, he's just come into my life a couple of months ago. Yeah.
Yeah. So
very highly spoken of, I understand.
Yeah. Some of his stuff is just way beyond my intellect. His precision is incredible. He has stunning simplicity and then very, very long stuff as well. A bit like Eckhart Tolle, you know. He's like, why is this sentence? I'm trying to read this sentence. Why is this sentence so long? I've lost my track here. I'm not bright enough to get it. But he talks about the absence of resistance as peace and love. He says it slightly differently. I can't remember exactly how he puts it, but that kind of sums it up. So we often hear kind of, I guess, the traditional way that we think of love as the opposite of love as love and hate. And then other people talk about love and love and fear being opposites. And Rupert Spira doesn't make it about opposites at all. It's about love is what's left when everything else is gone. So, and he talks about resist, you know, the absence of resistance is love underneath it. So to me, that sounds like a simplistic way of me taking all that you've shared and kind of saying, well, this, if we're resisting in any way whatsoever, then we've moved away from love.
Yeah, we don't use the words resistance in the work. Brian kind of early on came up with a theory about love and fear, that all behaviors stem from either love or from fear. And I can see that as being true, just like I can see what you're saying about love is what's left after you take away everything else, which I feel is probably also true. But in terms of dealing with kids, Brian's feeling was that if a child is, let's just say simply, misbehaving, whatever that happens to mean, it's coming from a sense of fear and stress in the child. So calm the stress, diminish the behavior would be sort of like the watchword or the tagline here. If a parent just simply approached behaviors at the level of calm the stress, diminish the behavior, their approach would be entirely different from anything that we've been given from, you know, past generations, as far as I could see. But to get to that point it's the long road. Partially because we're asking people, parents, to accept something that, quite frankly, almost seems not true, too good to be true, for one. But nobody is giving that message in a day-to-day world in terms of parenting. Nobody's presenting that message. So to be able to...
Well, it's a good job you're on this podcast, David.
Well, thank you. To be able to get parents to embody that, let's just say. Yeah. And Karen Purvis, we've got a video, an audio, an interview that Brian did with Karen, which I want to send you a link to that, or send you the interview. She, as you may know, was one of the saints, and her gentleness, you could just tell from listening to her, she has the most gentle approach to working with parents, with children. That to me is modeling exactly what we're talking about. But she's one of the rare few that ever even treads in that direction, let alone has the practical know-how and experience to be able to deliver that message, which is these children need love. Anything else is going to cause resistance, as you might say.
I came up with an idea, a metaphor last week, which I'd like to try out on you. And it was two cars, like two cars on a roller coaster, and the misbehaving, traumatized, angry kid is in one car, right, and the parents in the other car. Now, the path in front of us is going down. We're going down into fear, anger. The kid's car is going down, so the kid's consciousness is dropping. Right now, the parent is in the other car, and they've got to a fork, and they can either go down with their child into this conflict and into this pit of anger, or they can take the other fork of the roller coaster and actually climb up. So it's basically down to love, down to fear, anger, and conflict, or up to love. And that's what I thought that was, in terms of seeing where we're coming from. Because what's happening with Karen Purvis, her behavior, her tone of voice, I'm even slowing down now because I'm kind of reflecting back what you said to me, right?
Perfect.
So yes. her behavior is coming from love, and it's gentle and it's slow, and it's pace, there is space. She's taken the higher ground. She has taken the high road. She has taken the path to love, rather than the fork down into the anger and the conflict and the resistance that the child has gone. And sooner or later, the child will see that their response will change, because they will be lifted. They will be lifted by the parent that is taking them up. And as one of my mentors says, enthusiasm does what for, and love does for people what hot air does for balloons. And we will lift the child back up. You mentioned Gandhi earlier on. So we will be the change that we want to see in the world. But normally he was talking about, I'd always got that as be the change we want to see in the world, like my macro change. And what we're talking about here is micro change, how our kid is behaving in the minute. What do you make of that?
I think it's beautiful. It goes back to what I said earlier about a parent can't take a child where they themselves have not gone. To make that move up into love is the way to bring that child up from the pits of survival. When children experience this, the bottom line is their survival is being threatened. You could say that 99.99% of the time when a child is reacting in a parental child intervention or interaction there, the child is feeling threatened. If they weren't feeling threatened, they would be behaving different. So when a parent threatens a child, all they're doing is pouring gasoline on the fire. I think it's a beautiful example, and I would say use it.
Yeah.
Use it.
Have you heard of a guy called David Hawkins, Power versus Force? Have you heard of that?
No, that one I haven't.
So I sometimes mention this. I mentioned it recently. So it's a map of human consciousness. It's a map of human consciousness, and what that means is it's a scale. It's the scale of the roller coaster. The roller coaster that I just explained. Very simply, he goes into that. It's a way of looking at that. So people, I'll put a link into the show notes on that. People might like to check that book out, because it goes from 0 to 1,000. It's a map of consciousness, and anything below. So unconditional love, I think it scores at 500 on the scale from 1,000. And the great religious avatars, I appreciate that you said that you're non-denominational, but you were into some woo-woo stuff, I think, in the 70s, you said, I don't know, did I say woo-woo? Yeah.
You did, and probably still am in some people's appreciation.
Yeah. Well, me too, I love the woo-woo stuff. As long as it's not too woo-woo. I have a woo-woo threshold. I don't. Anyway, so 1,000 is the 1,000 is the great religious avatars in terms of their unconditional love, shame is 20. Shame is 20, and obviously there's a lot of shame around the kids that come from hard places. That there is a lot of shame in the worlds of addiction, abuse, neglect, all this sort of stuff. So that when you look at that, when you think shame is 20, zero is dead. So it makes really good sense when you map it across to this world of adoption, foster, and kids from hard places, trauma.
That sounds great. I'd like to look that book up myself.
Yeah. He's got a lot of, David Hawkins got a lot, there's a lot of videos on YouTube. He's not with us anymore, the guy. I love the audio versions of the book that he narrates, and watching him on video. So what, in terms of, how did you express this? We can't take our kids where we haven't been ourselves. Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Yeah. So doing our own work, what, I guess my recommendation of this book is kind of the first thing that popped into my head about doing our own work. Because, when people say do their own work, they think therapy, they think money, they think time. I'm a big consumer of audios and obviously podcasts, because I can do that whilst I'm driving, walking the dog, and it makes for a more effective learning for me. Time paused up. What would you like to share in terms of going where we want our kids to go, being the change that we want to see in the world? And doing our own work as parents?
Well, two examples I think I'd like to share that may help parents to find some alternatives to their particular way of responding, reacting to children. The first one's a little bit simpler. Sending children to their room has been around, seems like, as long as parents have been around. And Brian and Karen Purvis's approach has always been use time in instead of time out. But sometimes a child runs off to their room, slams the door. And parents are, sometimes that's a little bit frightening, a little scary, because we're not sure what's going on. We're not sure what the child's going to do. And Brian's approach, and I've tried this, I know what it's like from the inside, is instead of reacting, let's say, a parent, or in my case, I would go up, I would knock on the door and say, honey, can I come in? No. You know what? I'm just going to sit out here. I'll be sitting right here outside your door. If you want to come out and talk or be with me, I'll be right here. So I sit there. Now, who has the time to just sit there? But what's more important, you know, my child in this case, and many of these weren't my children, of course, but certainly I wanted to approach it as if they were. What happens is eventually the child will come out. Now, if the parent has to go downstairs, got to prepare a meal, got to do something, it's, you know what, honey, I'm going to be downstairs. I know you're fine. Everything will be okay. I'm going to be down in the kitchen. If you want to come down, go ahead and come down. The whole idea is to invite the children rather than force the children into behaving, quote, or acting a certain way. That can be used in any number of circumstances. My wife and I both experienced this. You know, go take one of these foster kids, go somewhere, get out of the car, and instead of going into the building, the child starts to run around. And eventually the parent, which was us, start to run after the child. And a parent running after a child in a parking lot where the child is screaming gets to be a really weird situation. And I can't tell you how many times Susan has said, you know, if I would have just stood there and just waited instead of, quote, threatening the child, chasing after them, it would have turned out so much differently. We had one of our children was, this was early on after we had met Brian, was trying to climb into the refrigerator. This was like weird. This was very threatening to Susan. She was like freaking out. The kid is trying to get into the refrigerator. And so I said, let's just call Brian. You know, let's get his input on this. So we call Brian and Brian says, can he fit into the refrigerator? She said, no, there's shelves and, you know, stuff in there. Is there any chance he could get hurt doing this? She said, well, no. And he kind of went through a couple of steps just to make sure there was nothing in danger at this point. There was no real danger other than the terror that my wife was experiencing. And he just said, just let him, just stand there and be with them. I know that sounds strange. I know that's not a typical way of handling children. But when parents can get past their own panic, their own trauma, their own patterns that they've been using to threaten, punish, take things away from children, when we can just start to be with kids in their terror, in their survival issues, in their fear, stuff just starts to fall away. It's as best as I can say it, that path toward love, that child eventually starts to loosen up because they're no longer feeling threatened. Their behaviors start to change. But it comes from the parent changing their behaviors first of all.
See, not doing anything when the kid's trying to climb into a fridge that they can't climb into, that is not resisting. That's a lovely concrete example. And I know listeners will appreciate concrete examples. To go with my sometimes more philosophical approach. I'm just looking at time and I'm thinking that might be a great place to bring this in. Have you got anything else that you'd like to share?
No, I'm good. I've given you what I have today.
Yeah, it's been great. And for a guy who says he wasn't sure, it prefers writing to talking, I think you've done a great job.
Now, I will say, Simon, I've never had a child, never wanted children. So the fact that I'm here is more due to the Lord works in mysterious ways for me to do the work. But it's not because I have a love for children in all this. I just have a love for love. And children, I think, are one of the most vulnerable and greatest opportunities because the future is in our children. It always is in our children.
A love of love. I like that. I love that. That's a great place to end. Thanks for joining us, David, and thanks for listening. See you again soon.